From the Roots Up. CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
This is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. I didn't hear them warning you that this is my own opinion and not the opinion of the station, but I'll just mention that. Phil Conlon is here.
Hello, Phil. Good afternoon. It's also my opinion and not the opinion of the station.
That's right. Or anybody in the, above the 52nd parallel or whatever. We're going to talk about a number of things, but there's next week... there's going to be a visit to Toronto and to Hamilton by, Judy Bellow is going to be talking about this new book, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, an anthology of social justice activists, a project of the Sanctions Kill campaign. You know, the Taylor Report, we've named... The United States, is, we explained that the letters stand for Uncle Sanctions. Whatever is going on in the world, it's Uncle Sanctions. And by the way, next week, we're going to be talking to the editor of the book, Sarah Flounders. She'll be on next Monday at 5 p.m. And I believe that very same day at the different book list, Judy Bellow will be speaking about her essay in the book and about the general problem which flows from the American strategy, I guess you can call it strategy, of sanctioning anybody who doesn't agree with them or because you're in a bad mood. It's a very stupid policy, and of course it's followed diligently by the Prime Minister of Canada, that's his job. So at a different book list, 7 o'clock, I believe on the 18th, the way to know for sure is to go to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and the times and dates will be available there, but the presentation at 7 o'clock at a different book list, a different book list is on Bathurst Street. Phil, I think you, by memory, know the address. This is a test.
Yeah, it's got a lot of sevens in it. 775 or 777.
There you go.
Right, Bathurst Street.
South of Bloor.
South of Bloor. You can't miss it.
On the east side.
Yeah.
It's a very distinguished place.
It's got two doors.
Two doors.
If you walk past the first one, you can still go in the second one.
You can get in the second one. Yeah. The book is Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. On the 19th, Judy Bellow is speaking in Hamilton at a bookstore, and I will get you the address. Knocks over something to do it. I guess it's pronounced Michael, M-I-K-E-L, Michael Coffee House, 100 King Street West, 7 p.m. And I believe there's also an event in Ottawa. Sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but probably most of you are not going to be going to Ottawa anyway. But again, go to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And it's a book launch in Toronto at a different book list, 7 p.m. Monday, and in Hamilton on the 19th. I'm almost absolutely sure. So, again, the way to be absolutely sure and to see Judy Bellow is to go to the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.
They have a Facebook page called Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War.
There you go.
So they also have a website, but go to the Facebook page and you'll get some up-to-date information.
Yeah, thank you. That's the voice of Phil Conlon. And... Well, Phil, we have a number of things we'd like to talk about today. I have to say, you must have heard this, that they're claiming the Dalai Lama had a bad moment. I don't know what, how
well, there's photographic evidence of the Dalai Lama's bad moment.
Yeah, and CNN and put it on.
Of course, it's interesting to know why they would have, but nonetheless.
No. Yeah. Go ahead and say that again, because there's something odd about that.
Yeah. It's who knows if this is ordinary behavior for him or if he's just reverting to something that is said to have been a practice among the feudal class that he comes from. Who knows? Caitlin Johnstone wrote about it in very colorful language this morning.
Caitlin,
and she said that it's actually a practice of the feudal class in Tibet. It's one of the ways they controlled the serfs, was to abuse boys. Now, I don't know if it's true or not.
You do not know.
But and she then, you know, after talking about the incident, which is there's photographic evidence of it, and it's really disgusting to look at.
Oh, I watched.
Yeah.
I have to admit it. I watched. Okay.
You know, look, everybody's watched, right? And of course, you know, I had to make a comment because I'm a little sensitive in this subject. I say that if a Catholic priest had done that, there'd be a parliamentary inquiry, and the police would be on the job and everything else, right?
Well, but if it was the Pope.
Yeah.
It's a Pope, and they would say, yeah, that's kind of odd.
Yeah.
You see, that's where, you know, what is it? Clergy meets law.
But you know, Caitlin took the opportunity to talk about the Dalai Lama's past association with the CIA. He seems to have been cashiered by the CIA, incidentally. That's what it kind of looks like.
Isn't he semi-retirement?
Semi-retirement, yeah.
Yeah. Because they're gearing up for the next, who's going to be the next Dalai Lama.
Right, yeah.
And as you know, America is committed to religious freedom, is prepared to go to war to have their Dalai Lama,
right.
But actually, we don't know if it's actually true until Richard Gere has spoken. So,
there is him. Richard has devoted his life to freeing Tibet,
and he's also cleared up all questions of this type.
Right.
So,
he hasn't been to Tibet in 50 years, of course, because he's not allowed into China because of his activity. So he just reports on it from a distance. You know.
Well, I don't know if he's just kind of odd character.
Yeah.
And yes, Hollywood seems to be, wherever you have a problem, Hollywood shows up. And they attach a movie star to whatever the issue is.
You remember South Sudan? That was the cause celebre. And Clooney was the big hero.
Well, and Don Cheadle. Is that his name, Don Cheadle?
Yes.
Cheadle. And he was there on the Darfur front.
Yeah.
Actually, so was General Dallaire, but he's all.
He's not a Hollywood star. Come on.
There's a lot of star quality in what he does. So this is the Taylor Report, and we're getting at these burning issues. I want to say that we passed an important date, and usually on the Taylor Report, we remark on it. And that is April the 6th, which is the date of the assassination of two African presidents, the president of Burundi and the president of Rwanda were assassinated, together with the head of the Rwandan army on April the 6th, 1994. I emphasize that it was two African presidents. Because to this date, there has not been anything resembling an attempt to establish who did it. We have had an international criminal court, which was an ad hoc court, but that court chose to put aside the project of investigating the assassination. When it was formed, people seemed to lose track of who was involved. Mr. Goldstone, a South African lawyer, a very prominent individual in the world of human rights, he was the original prosecutor. But the next one, the one who succeeded him before the trials began, was none other than Louise Arbour, who is, I think everybody understands, is a saint here. For example, we had the recent issue of the Chinese Canadians and the CSIS and leaks, and they were looking around for someone they said was gravitas and credibility, and to show you how bankrupt and silly we are as a country, they actually were talking about Louise Arbour, because I just told you two African presidents were killed, murdered, assassinated on April the 6th, and all sides agree that what followed, the clash between the Rwandan army and the so-called Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, really began at that moment. The war had begun, and that's very important to know too. It had begun in October 1990. Phil, you were around at the time, and I remember. I was curious about this war because I knew a number of former leftists and progressives, anti-imperialist people, etc., who had gone into the NGO game, and they were poking around in Africa, being paid, well paid, by the way. And so I was wondering, what are they up to? What's going on here? And so I looked in the New York Times, because you know, where else would you turn? And you remember when people used to say, it must be true, I read it in the New York Times?
That was their slogan.
That was a New Yorker cartoon, yeah, right?
That's right. That's right.
No, their slogan is, all the news is fit to print,
right,
which is paraphrased lie. But but people used to say, did you see the Times? You know. So anyway, I thought they might help me out, and they did. They had a long piece, a feature, and I was reading it very diligently. And about halfway through a very long article, which ran from page 1 into page 17 or something, it said that the leader of the RPF, Paul Kagame, was a former general in the Ugandan army, which caused me to stand up from where I was reading. I remember distinctly, I said, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. He's a general in the Ugandan army, and you're calling this a civil war. And of course, it was an invasion in October. Mr. Kagame had not been there. He was actually being trained in a U.S. military facility. I forget which one, might have been Quantico. They train a lot of foreign officers to get trained there. And so, the leader, Mr. Fred Wegema, was killed in the first days of action in October 1990. They crossed over. All the troops that they were leading were Ugandan soldiers who happened to be a portion of them. I don't even know if the majority of them were Rwandans. These were, they called Rwandan refugees in Uganda, but who were members of Museveni's army. Rwanda argued at the time that the African, what was called the, I don't know if it was called the African Union, it's changed its name, but they said this is an act of aggression. But because this was the heyday of American power and unipolarism, they were told you couldn't say that. It had to be called a civil war, even though they'd been invaded by members of a foreign army, Ugandan army. The president of Uganda, Mr. Museveni, said he was surprised. He hadn't known about this. By the way, he didn't say, I'm going to arrest them, I'm going to close the border, because they were going back and forth across that border from 1990 to 1994. But again, to come to 1994, two presidents are assassinated. Anyone taking up the subject said, well, we have to know who did that, because what resulted was a clash of armies, massacres of civilians, known as the genocide, and a seizure of power by one of the parties. And this is, and the ICTR, the International Criminal Court for Rwanda, UN, was set up in 1990, the decision was made in 94. I think the first trial was 1996. But what was striking is that Luis Arbour made a decision that they would not continue an investigation of the shooting down of the plane. On the Taylor Report, we had Michael Hourigan, who was an Australian investigator and lawyer who was heading up the investigation of the shootdown, because he had originally been assigned, he and a former FBI agent and Amadou Dem from Senegal, who was a Senegalese army officer, served in Rwanda. The three of them were already on the job and had given Luis Arbour a preliminary report saying they had witnesses and the arrow was pointing at the RPF and their leader. And they were told, and Michael Hourigan said it on this show. He's written about it, he's been interviewed about it, but it has disappeared into the black hole of nobody wants to know. But he said he was called in and told to turn over all of his work and then never to speak of the matter again. So here we are all these years later and no one knows. And there was a cry. It was assumed that they were going to look into that assassination. They did not. The president of Kenya, Arap Moi, said that should be the job one. And he was told, oh, yeah, we're going to do that. He wasn't the only African leader, but he's the one who I recall most, who spoke out the loudest and first, saying, hey, listen, presidents, two of the presidents, the president of Burundi has been assassinated, along with the president of Rwanda. Incidentally, I don't do the names because just keep saying president. That's the head of the whole country. And remember that the United States and Britain, everybody practically called everything to a halt in the Middle East when a former prime minister of Lebanon was assassinated. A former prime minister. They said, oh, we have to have an investigation. By the way, George Clooney's wife got a big job there. If you don't know, that whole thing went down a rat hole. It has disappeared. Unfortunately, it didn't take her with it, or George Clooney, but it led nowhere. But that, the United States said, was that, you know, the thing was they expected to be able to pin it on the president of Syria. The game was that it must have been the Syrians. Therefore, they wanted an investigation because they wanted an excuse to destroy the government of Syria, which turned out later they didn't need an excuse. They went ahead and tried anyhow under Obama and all subsequent U.S. presidents. So they would stop the world, practically, to look into a former PM of Lebanon, but they would not even, squelch the investigation of the two presidents. If you want to learn more about this, I recommend you. Ann Garrison in Black Agenda Report has an essay. I think it's probably a week or two old at the moment. Not that, maybe 10 days. But you should look at it because she also includes a letter written by Paul Roussas-Abagina, who has been in the headlines because Paul was kidnapped and taken to Rwanda and held up quite a long time. And Anne found a letter he had written, I think it was in 2008, in which he laid out the case that the evidence had pointed at the RPF and that the world needed to know the truth about that assassination. Because as was echoed by former prosecutor Carla Del Ponte and a few others, not by Louise Arbour. She remains silent, so does our great general, the wonderful General Dallaire. Neither of them talk about this. They're not interested. But Carla Del Ponte and Goldstone, I think, also has said that, you know, in interviews, and by the way, it's not very helpful, these blasted interviews where you say to the person, listen, you had the job. You have cachet. You have entree. You can talk to people. Why don't you just go ahead and make a case of some type to force the issue? But what they say is, wow, you know, if the RPF did it, our understanding, and I'm quoting practically Carla Del Ponte, if the RPF did it, assassinated the two presidents, then you have to, it turns the whole story of the 1994 events upside down, turns it completely around, which all people who have any kind of conscience and who try to establish the truth, everybody understands that's the fact. We never got that investigation. You want to read the letter. It's an attachment to the article by Ann Garrison, and it's in Black Agenda report. But I wanted to make sure we touched on that and remind everybody that it was on April the 6th, 1994, two presidents. And it tells you also what the Western world thinks of Africa. They have any use for Africa at all. It's just a place to put, what they say, footstool. And it's repulsive, but it has to be repeated. So this is the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. We're going to come back and talk about CSIS and CIA and where we're headed. And we got the appropriate voice for the appropriate song to get us there. That's what I'm looking for, is suspicious minds. The proverb, I repeat it often, fear has magnifying eyes. And, for your mental health, to all people, they say, being suspicious will end up destroying you. If you can, a little bit of suspicion, not bad, but now we have a situation where, and here's my favorite moment, Phil, I don't know if you saw the story, but it's more than one pundit, so I won't make it just one story, but has been reported as news by the Globe and Mail and Global, whatever it is. Our major pundits on TV, and they say, we're in a tough situation in Canada because the Liberal government is too complacent in the face of Chinese skullduggery. And a sign of how bad the situation is it says that the American intelligence agencies are worried that Canada is not sufficiently concerned about foreign interference. and we're letting them down. That's where we've arrived, is that the Americans say, what's the matter with you guys? You don't notice all the foreign interference? You say, you mean from you? No, I mean, nobody even asked that question. And
Are the Americans even foreigners to the Canadian establishment?
Are they what?
Are they even foreigners, the Americans? I mean, they...
No, well, according to... I mean, Biden says we are now bound and tied and wrapped up and deep and... Yeah. And I, did you see when he called out Michael Kovrig and his name, and Kovrig stood up and saluted? And I thought, well, there you are, a Canadian civilian saluting the President of the United States. What could be more innocent? It was absurd. But this notion, see, we're starting to get a real bead on what's going on. Because, like today, we're once again reminded, one of the ministers, I forget which one, the Canadian government said, we are going to be in touch with our associates in the Five Eyes group and establish, you know, make sure we have each other's backs or confidence. But Five Eyes is... It means we don't have an independent intelligence operation. We're part of a group of five, and let's define it very clearly. This is the old British and American, Anglo-American system. This is actually the Russians and the Chinese use the term Anglo-Saxon. They say these are the Anglo-Saxons. And people, there's nothing to laugh at because according to self-definitions, that's what it is. The Five Eyes are English-speaking. Five Eyes are Protestants. The Five Eyes are Anglo-Saxons. That's who they are. And it's New Zealand, Australia, United States, and UK. Did I leave somebody out? Us is us. But so, in other words, and that can't work. It's because you see, if Canada has a foreign policy. And it says, well, you know, maybe we'd like to be more like France, for example. Macron, by the way, was just in Beijing. He was there and was introduced together with von Leyen of the European Union, represented. Two of them were brought in. And there's actually, go to Carl Zsa's Twitter account, because he makes a good joke. He said, Macron doesn't have a space, he doesn't understand space. So... He says, is he trying to show up or get closer to President Xi than von Leyen? I don't know if you saw the picture. But, you know, leaders stand side by side. So she's about, I would say, an arm's length to President Xi's left. And on his right, standing next to his shoulder, is Macron. And I don't know, but, you know, Canada's... So what does that tell you, going back to the Five Eyes? The plan, apparently, is to see if we can isolate ourselves in warp time. Like, let's get this thing done. I mean, there's nobody but us. It's the five. And so if you are a little bit out of step, if you're New Zealand, if you're Canada, your fellow intelligence groups are watching you. And they're not trusting you. Suspicious minds. That was Dwight Yoakam, my favorite. I like him because the first city I ever visited was Bakersfield, and the song was "Walk the Streets of Bakersfield." The challenge: have you ever? And I did, yes. But here's Five Eyes, and so Canada, Australia, and the United States, which is. Really, they seem to be the leading elements, want to bring in and have brought in. The United States did theirs in 1938. Foreign agent registry. And now Australia has done it, and it is the dream of the Globe and Mail that we become like Australia. You know, by the way, Phil, you know the reputation of Australia as a warm, friendly place that all the rest of the world says, gee, those are brother. Those Australians are really, we're all so close to them. They have brought it in, foreign registry, agent registry. Allegedly, this will make us all safe. I suspect, you see, if you're having meetings, do you need this? Australians and Americans are going to tell you yes. I'm talking about, this little gang of suspicious, mediocre people get together. They say, yeah, you know, you have to get with it. And so if you don't, I assume that they're motivated to leak something. Or get one of you in the Canadian group who really wants to be an Australian. His dream in life is to be an Australian, do everything like them. And so he says, well, hey, we're out of step. I'm going to leak some of this stuff. And then when there is a leak, everybody says, well, gee, it shows that there's a demoralized group. Our CSIS must be demoralized because now they're starting to leak. And that shows bad, and we got to straighten it out. So that was what they were saying a week ago. Now, today, you know the headlines, is somebody in the CIA is leaking. Right? I don't know if you have any insights, Phil, as to which group. They have a lot of intelligence groups. The Army has one, Navy has one, the Marines. No, I don't think the Marines have one. Navy, the Army, everybody from Wisconsin to Oklahoma has an intelligence group. Watching Americans. So anyway, there's a leak. So they're supposed to be the gold standard of super security people, top secret stuff. So are they imitating the Canadian guy? We're starting to have sort of a chaos in the intelligence community. And it's not pretty to watch, but it does tell you that the people you got to be careful about are the ones who say they're protecting you, right? When they put a writer on like Edward Dahlberg says, if someone puts his arm around your shoulder and calls you brother, run for your life. And that's our situation with in the intelligence people. On the matter of deciding to call people to call on communities and elected people and others who meet a certain criteria to register as foreign agents is a Pandora's box of, you know, it's, in America they call it McCarthyism. I don't think McCarthyism really quite gets all the devilry that such a notion carries with it. Pascal, a French philosopher, I believe he was French, Pascal said that laws are passed to create crimes. So you have a community minding its own business. It's part of a democratic society. People run for office. And then somebody comes along and says, oh, we didn't like the outcome of the election. And we were suspicious of who you voted in. So we want somebody to now, we want people to register if we think that we can taint them. So then you say, okay, we're going to have a registry. Right away, the Globe and Mail, Global Times or whatever they call themselves, they will begin saying, oh, so-and-so ought to be registered. Or so-and-so is registered. So he's a member of the community, but now they've created the criteria so that they can call him a foreign agent. And what they're doing is just busy with their little fist erasing people's rights. Actually, I don't know why, if a community chose anybody, within a democracy, if someone wants to run and the community wants to elect them, that's who it is. It does, you know. Eugene Debs went to prison, right? And he's, by the way, Eugene Debs pulled a stretch. But he could run for office, and he got a lot of votes. So why didn't they just leave him alone and let him be who he was? Ironically, I suppose, we're looking at Donald Trump. he actually may be in jail and be elected president. I could see that happening. But this idea that we should register people, it just, all it leads is to more suspicion, more finger pointing, more criminalization, more bad blood, and it's all driven by a desire to turn Canada into part of the new war machine aimed at the People's Republic of China. At the end of the day, that's all this is about, is to put people on a war footing. You have to look around, so-and-so's a foreigner. I wonder if he must be with them. You know, we all stood up and he didn't stand up. I mean, that kind of stuff. And this game is self-defeating. Of course, it undermines democracy and the spirit of it. You remember, Phil, that the we had the situation of the Whispering Smith or Mr. X, the guy who, the individual who leaked the information, said about the fourth or fifth paragraph of his letter. He said, I don't believe that the election was affected, the outcome was affected. So obviously we need to fix the situation because nothing happened. So we could have another election and nothing would happen. I mean, it gets worse and worse. Still nothing happens. You have an election. People say what they're for. A sociologist or a political scientist, as we said on the show previous, would tell you how the votes are going to go. And if you have someone who lost an election and he says, I lost because of the foreigners, he's just a crybaby. And unless he can show somebody Jimmy the ballots, all that means is he's a crybaby. And the whole country should come to a halt and say, oh, he was the guy who had the best position on China. People should have voted for him. They didn't feel like voting for him. Because, by the way, one of those candidates was talking about registering foreign agents, which is a nice way to really upset that community. Because they say, I don't know, what is he up to? What kind of nonsense is this? We need that like a hole in our head. So this is where this thing is headed. It may be that we'll dodge a bullet here in that, you know, we do have many, many communities who come from different parts of the world, and when they hear the word foreign agent in registration, they may call their MPs and say, hey, you know, we put you in there, we voted for you, and you're going to stick this on us? I mean, that's not nice. Anyway, the cure in a democratic society for your problems is democracy. Hold an election, open the field to people who want to be represented to the people, what they want to do for them. As opposed to the new thought, which is candidates have to be vetted. CSIS people should vet candidates. You know, we actually have people serving in Parliament who brag that they approach CSIS for tips on how to spot foreign agents. And if I found out that somebody like that was in my area, I'd be totally against them. It's a disgrace.
You know, Phil, one of the distressing things about this is that the Canada's New Democrats have stolen a march on this stuff, and they put anybody who wants to be a candidate for the NDP has to be put through a process. And I don't know if the NDP actually consults CSIS, but it's almost as bad. I mean, they research everything about a person's background. Did they ever go to a meeting? Did they ever sign a petition? Did they ever have a conversation with somebody who's suspect? And then they decide, the bureaucracy of the party, who was not elected by anybody, decides, you cannot be our candidate, and nobody can do anything about it.
Right. No, that's the business of people used to have a... You remember from the period of 60s, 70s, people red-baited themselves. You know, they said, I'm not for that. Or it's only today if you say this war, we need a peace party. We need people who are for negotiating an end to the war. You have to first say, I'm against Russia. It was, yes. Oh, it was a brutal invasion, but... No, no, you don't actually have to say that. What you have to say is what will solve the problem. And also, if you were a humble person, you would say, I have a pretty good idea that NATO isn't the sweetest bunch of people, and I have noticed that the U.S. has invaded and bombed and destroyed and burned and killed a bunch of people from one side of the globe to the other. Therefore, I humbly suggest that leaders in Washington tone it down just a bit. Tone it down just a bit and talk about how they're going to solve this. But no, we have this, they create fear. So you have this person speaks defensively. I'm not for so-and-so. I never liked those guys. I'm completely against them. And then they think they can talk. You don't need to make apologetics to get you nowhere. And it's off the point, it's beside the point. So but we have this. And which leads me to another thing I want to make sure I say is that we don't actually work at knowing what other countries say and think, and we don't appreciate their representation. And I think, for example, I periodically to know what is the position of the People's Republic of China on any question or the questions of the day, you can go to the foreign ministry and they have a spokesperson. And men and women come forward, well spoken. And they, in asking them questions, are people from Reuters, actually Globe and Mail, French press, various British journals. Anyway, they ask questions, and by the way, they're not polite. They ask a lot of very impolite questions, cynical questions. They like to make little side observations, and the spokesperson to the Chinese Foreign Ministry answers their questions, sometimes equally snide and equally sarcastic, depending upon what they're hearing. I'm not aware of any foreign, of our Canada doing any such thing. Certainly, do I see a Russian journalist or a Chinese journalist asking a question of a spokesperson in Ottawa? I remember when Harper, way, way back when there was a pretense that they wanted to get along with China, although Harper didn't agree, but there's a NATO Five Eyes consensus at the time that we were going to make nice. It was cynical, fingers crossed behind your back. But Harper wasn't buying any of it because his political base wants him to be continually baiting. So there was a Chinese journalist who used to come to any occasion where the prime minister was taking questions and would raise his hand and was never permitted to ask a question. But on one occasion, they had all gone off to the Arctic together and they'd taken an entourage, and the Chinese journalist came along. So the pool of reporters said, you know, we think you ought to answer his question. And so they allowed one time for him to ask a question. And I think he got sloughed off because that would be Harper. By the way, the spirit of Harper is all over Canada now. It's Trudeau now has got, you look at him closely, you say, I think that was Harper, you know, because, and then the Americans have the same problem that they say it's a different guy, but the policy seems to have the same odor. But it's just striking. And I would tell you, I've never seen a Russian and Chinese journalist at the, when the daily, the Americans do a daily thing, they're fairly consistent. It's a little less predictable. But they, there's no question, there's not four or five correspondents from China or Russia who ask them questions. So ask yourself, well, how come? You know,
actually, from watching that, I don't see that any foreign journalists, even from those who are U.S. allies, get to ask questions. It's, you know, NBC, Fox, CNN, NBC, Fox, and CNN, and, you know.
Yeah, and they have their domestic differences with each other. The domestic difference is the United States, do you like Trump or not? And because it's going to be 24-hour, 365 Trump. And so you either tear your hair out or you're blowing kisses. So they say, boy, do we have democracy. We differ all the time about Trump. But actually, this recent, for example, Taiwan matter, where Canada is totally on side, the NDP, Judy Squo and others, they're going to go to Taiwan to see how much trouble they can make. Let me predict ahead, not much, because it's understood who they are. But the top Republican, Mr. McCarthy, he and Pelosi both engaged in exactly the same exercise, which was making nice with the elected leader of Taiwan, who's an independence person. And they do this without any self-consciousness of lying through their teeth, because they said that they recognize there's one China, and Taiwan is part of China. But now they're all turning this into arguing about angels on the head of a pin. It's Taiwan is part of China. It's called the Republic of China, by the way. We probably ought to go back to using it here. China, People's Republic, they don't use that nomenclature because they had a war with the people who formed the government on Taiwan, and it was the old Republic of China gang, Chiang Kai-shek. They, by the way, are much more, well, of course, their opinion is that, of course, Taiwan part of China, because after all, when they were in the United Nations representing the whole continent, which they didn't, I mean, the whole country, not continent, the whole country, from Taiwan, they were called China. And so that's their position, that China is, you know, Taiwan and China, one country. But the Americans have flip-flopped and have gone from thinking we want China to be a friend because they wanted to use them against Russia, and that was Richard Nixon's great contribution. And I do appreciate, if anybody wants to see some fun pictures, look at Nixon and Mao Zedong. And Nixon really liked that visit. He went around quoting Mao for quite a while. And then there's Kissinger and Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and all the great figures in history. They really were big figures. So now we're back to, no, we really think that we've got to do something for Taiwan, which is self-destructive. It will isolate Five Eyes more. By the way, Macron, one of his principal messages of the visit, Macron said, he doesn't take the same view as the U.S., so this is a major fellow. And von Leyen, she didn't get into the subject, but she clearly is not interested in making trouble over Taiwan. So what we're talking about is a net loss for Canada, because it's a net loss for the boss. If it's a loss for the boss, it's a loss for Canada. I don't know if you know this, Phil, but President of Brazil, Mr. Lula, is going to be in Beijing for a visit. And he said the two subjects are going to be closer cooperation. And of course, he's not even interested in Taiwan. He says he and President Xi are going to be talking about a peace proposal for Ukraine. That's what Lula says he's going to be doing. Meanwhile, the press here played up the fact that this woman from the territory of China called Taiwan visited Guatemala and Belize, and they both affirmed that they still recognize Taiwan. So she didn't and the press did not play up the fact that Honduras, which used to be in America's hip pocket and always recognized, it was always close with Taiwan, has changed its policy. They have a very brilliant, progressive woman leading Honduras now. Very, very impressive individual. But it's not remarked here. People should be saying, what happened to the Lima group? Where's Guaido? What's all this big, smart stuff we were doing? You're doing nothing. You're falling on your face. You're laughable. But you keep it all here because you're in an Anglo-Saxon silo, and you all talk to each other, and you still think the World Series is Brooklyn versus the Yankees. It's absurd. And I suppose we should take heart from all this news. And incidentally, let's talk about our Canadian politicians and how they talk about China. The NDP ought to shut up about this, and the Liberals and everybody else using the term aggressive when they talk about China, because occupied South Korea, it's an occupied country. The Americans are there, 40,000 U.S. military personnel. They, every year, they and the South Koreans play war games. And the war game involves bombers that are capable, outfitted and designed to carry nuclear weapons, fly directly at the border, straight at the border of North Korea. They do that every year. And we have morons in the parliament who dare to talk such a stupid language of who's being aggressive. That is, and you're occupying South Korea. You say, oh, South Korea thinks. What do you mean they think? You're occupying them. How can you even discuss them as though they have an independence? Same with Japan. Japan is occupied to this day by the United States. They've been there since the end of World War II. And yet we have MPs who blather about who acts in an aggressive way. They send American warships through the Taiwan Straits, as they think that's something you just do. It's a completely ignorant and belligerent thing to do. It's not necessary at all. And all that is the old colonial claim, imperialist claim, on the region, on the whole of Asia. The U.S. likes to say, oh, we're a Pacific country. Yeah. I know you, well, you are, yes, but you're on the wrong side of it. Why don't you stay on your own side of the Pacific? And either that or we should have Chinese ships circling Hawaii or sailing up to the San Francisco Bay and having a look around, you know. They'll find a lot of homeless people, but that just depress them. But I mean, that would be appropriate behavior on the part of another power who doesn't appreciate being put through this exercise. But anyway, that's the situation we're in. Going to the latter part of this, maybe we have a little taste of something. Do you have that Merle Haggard thing? I want to tell you something about Tule Lake, or Tulare Lake.
Tulare dust in a farm boy's nose, wondering where the freight train goes. Standing in a field by the railroad track, cursing the strap on my cotton sack. I can see Mom and Dad with shoulders low, both of them picking on a double row. They do it for a living because they must. That's life like it is in the Tulare dust. The California sun was something new. That winter we arrived in 42.
That's Merle talking about when he arrived. And Anyhow, that's a long story. But the reason I play that is that we have California Republican congressmen making all kinds of trouble. They're talking about going to Taiwan. They're underwater. That the dust that Merle is singing about in that song is now mud, because Tulare, which I remember very vividly, I'm from the area, it's a natural lake. That's why that land is so fertile in the South San Joaquin. And now we have a new lake. It wasn't there 1 year ago, but it's there now. And it's the largest lake west of the Mississippi. It's bigger than Lake Tahoe. And it runs basically from Taft up to Stockton and something along the west side of the state. And all those Republican congressmen who are worried about China Act ought to be talking about their counties because they're underwater. And when I grew up there, it was called Tule Lake. I didn't know it was called Tulare Lake. I had to come to here and read the New York Times. But it was, as far as I knew, it was Tule Lake. You see it referred to in a Hollywood movie called, I never should say I'm going to name a film, but it was about the city of Taft. And I think it was The Best of Times, where the big film begins. Everybody's wandering around in mud because there used to be, this lake comes and goes, Phil. In 1983, it showed up because you have heavy runoff from the snow. And this year they had they have both heavy snow, packed snow, 5-10 times more than they're used to, plus heavy rain. And guess, it has to go somewhere. And it goes to this area, which we call Tule Lake. And now it's Tulare.
Well, can't some water authority figure out a way to make money from that water and sell it to some farmers?
Phil, you're a natural-born entrepreneur. Lastly, I want to say the name of Linda Beauty. There's a demonstration at Portage in Maine in Winnipeg. Her body was found in a landfill. She was last seen climbing into, they say, to, I guess you call it a dumpster. Guess what, Phil? They say landfill. They mean dump. She's an indigenous woman.
Yeah.
She's from the Lake San Martin Nation, First Nation. And it is a tragedy because other bodies have been found there of indigenous women. But there is a big demonstration, has been a demonstration, there's going to be more at Portage in Maine and Manitoba. There should be demonstrations, one into Canada to another, over this business. And if you want to know all about it, you got to go see Land Acknowledgement by Cliff Cardinal. This is the Taylor Report. See you next week.